Which listener-submitted question should be covered next in WFAE's FAQ City podcast? Do you want to know the secret code to light up the 7th Street station? Or how Charlotte's neighborhoods got their names? Why are uptown high-rises shaped differently? Cast your vote and subscribe to the podcast at wfae.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We already know that affordable housing in Charlotte is in short supply. We know that rents are rising. We also know that those born into poverty in Charlotte tend to stay in poverty for their entire lives if they stay here. Well, now a new study from Princeton University professor Michael Desmond shows that Charlotte's eviction rate is twice as high as some of its peer cities. Just over 6 out of every 100 renter households in Charlotte were evicted in 2016, and that's above the national average. Desmond says eviction isn't just a condition of poverty, it's causing poverty, too. Well, this hour we examine both sides of that equation with Carol Hardison. She is CEO of Crisis Assistance Ministry. That's a nonprofit that provides emergency help with rent and utilities, and which is often the last stop before homelessness. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Ken Zemanski is Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
And Mary Newsom is Director of Urban Policy Initiatives at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, which recently instituted 3 reports looking at different facets of eviction. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You can join us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can search for WFAE on Facebook, get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks, and you can even watch us on Facebook Live. Given Charlotte's high eviction rate, Carol, and the fact that more than 28,000 evictions took place in Mecklenburg County in 1 year alone, is it safe to say that those who experience eviction are those who are already on the precipice of financial collapse, or are these people just, they've hit a rough patch for the first time in their lives, and they just can't make the rent?
You know, it's actually both and everything in between. Sometimes it's a family that has been stable all their lives, 2 incomes and college degrees, and someone gets cancer in the family and missed work causes a lost job, and then expenses that were never budgeted for, and suddenly they can find themselves facing homelessness. Mm-hmm. Other times it is people who were born into poverty, as you spoke of earlier, and all their life they have struggled, and they just haven't had that opportunity to get one step ahead.
How would you rate the ratio between those who are being evicted because they've always been poor and eviction makes you poorer versus those who have a rough patch in their lives and suddenly find themselves surprisingly homeless?
Yes. My estimate from the people that I see at Crisis Assistance Ministry, the majority of the folks have been making it and have a plan in life, but it's about a 3 to 6 month window that is all they're able to have a plan for. So the majority is in that realm. They're not living 1 week or 2 weeks away from eviction, but it's not more than 9 to 10 months.
I would think that people who have that kind of a cushion feel pretty comfortable until tragedy or troubles strike. That's fairly frightening.
Oh, it is amazing. There's a study that has said that over 30% of the population of Charlotte is within 90 days of being in poverty if they lost their main source of income.
Wow.
And so it really is people that you would be surprised to know face this.
Wow. So people should be listening to this conversation today.
To you.
The leading causes for eviction are what? Is it simply that you haven't planned well, that you hit this rough patch, that you can't pay both the costs of medicine or health care and your rent? What's the leading cause here?
Those are numerous causes, as well as a recent customer shared that she had an arrangement with her husband who was going to pay rent, her ex-husband who had left her, and expected that to be done and came home and found herself facing eviction. Sometimes the landlord has decided to tear down the property, and you come home and find out that you're going to be facing eviction. Sometimes it happens because you came home and found out your rent is going up $300 a month. Mm-hmm. So there are numerous causes. Certainly health and income is a great
so let's part of let's it. Clarify a term here, because you just said you come home and you find out the landlord is selling the property and therefore you're going to face eviction. That's not really eviction in the sense that we're talking about eviction. This is somebody saying we're going to sell this building, so you have to get out in 30 days because they won't be here in 60 days.
And that is part of this as well, especially in a community like this that's growing so much. A large part of it, not a majority by any sense, but a large number right now of people are finding themselves facing eviction because of the strong economic conditions that we're in.
Right. Okay. So Mary Newsom is here from the Urban Policy Initiative at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. People are considered cost burden. That's a term that we've used before on this program, when more than 30% of their gross income is spent on housing. And in Mecklenburg County in 2015, you found that about 45% of renters, about 80,000 households, were cost burdened, and that 22% of those people are paying half or more of their gross income in housing costs. That was before the economy here was in full recovery. Do you think that those numbers would hold today?
Let me just say, I didn't do that particular research. One of my colleagues, Ashley Clark, did that, and she's done 3 reports on evictions alone. I'm not sure, because while the economy is recovering, unemployment is way down, but at the same time, the cost of housing has just skyrocketed. Wages have not gone up as rapidly as the housing costs. So it'd be interesting to take another look at those numbers with more recent data.
What role did the recession play, the Great Recession play, in not only in evictions at the time of the recession, but putting people in a financial pit that they still haven't gotten themselves out of? So now something that they probably never imagined that could happen, eviction, is a possibility for them.
Yeah, I think the whole issue of families' ability or lack of ability to build wealth is real important. It's one of the elephants in the room that doesn't get talked about much. If you're evicted, it's a huge cost suck on your budget. In addition to losing your home, you probably have to pay court costs. You probably have to pay an eviction fee that the landlords can charge you. You either have to pay to move your stuff, or you have to pay to have it stored, and you may or may not get it back if you can't keep up your storage payments. You may well have to buy all new furniture or acquire all new furniture. You probably have to put down for your new apartment, you either have to put down a rent deposit or more likely put down a surety fee, which if it's a deposit, you'll get it back when you move out if you haven't trashed the place. If it's a fee, you don't get it back. It's just gone. So the poorer you are, the more it costs you.
And there are fees to transfer utilities and things like that. So if you lose your house without planning, it's going to cost you money you already don't have.
Exactly.
What you're saying. We have the Ken Zemanski, who's executive director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, with us. What's an eviction fee, and why would a landlord get a fee for that? If the person can't pay the rent, and that's why they're being evicted, how would you expect them to pay that fee?
You cannot proceed with an eviction without going through the court system.
Okay.
You can't ask a resident effectively to vacate. So you have to go through the court system, and that requires paying a fee to the clerk of superior court. And the standard in the industry is to be made whole, to get that fee back from the household that brought about the lawsuit. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had to initiate it, as sad and as unfortunate as it is, to proceed with evictions. That's being made whole again because you had that unexpected expense. If that were in the cost of doing business, that cost would be spread to all the other consumers that weren't filed on for eviction. And when we talked about eviction.
What is the fee, by the way?
The fee is it's about $200. It's somewhat variable, but it's about $200.
Okay. And do you get paid that fee normally? I mean, does the person you're evicting, if they lose the case in court, do they end up actually physically handing over the money at some point?
If they want to stay, and Carol talked about the number that were filed, being maybe 28,000 are filed, but only about 10,000 go all the way through. So a number of residents, about two-thirds, end up paying and staying. That lawsuit is rescinded, and then that resident will, in fact, stay in the apartment.
So they pay the back rent and the fee.
Yeah, and they may pay a late fee also, which is like 5% of the rent, which is statutory. It's been state law for about 30 years, isn't it? 5% of the rent.
Okay. You say at Crisis Assistance Ministry that your customers, Carol, average their average gross monthly income, this is gross, this is before taxes, is $1,327, while the average rent in Charlotte for a two-bedroom apartment is $1,468. That is an impossible equation. So who are these people, and why is their income so low? And given that what do you get for less than $1,468 a month?
I'll take the second question first.
Okay.
Largely unsafe, not your strongest apartments. Maybe we hear about bugs and tears and broken air conditioners and bullets going through windows at night for the second
part. Because 30% of 1327 is about $400.
Yes.
So that's what you, if you didn't want to be income burdened, your rent should only be $400. What do you get for $400 in Charlotte?
It's the stories that we hear. Yeah, that my child was grazed by a bullet and this was the only apartment that I could afford, and there's rats, and I'm afraid to tell my landlord because this is the only place I can afford.
If there are rats and it's infested with bugs or the place is not safe because of other things, why are they allowed to rent it?
So they're, like I said, it's what they can afford, and so they're afraid to tell. Now, laws protect them. They can tell, and it's against the law for the landlord to retaliate. But if it's all I could afford and I didn't feel I had power and I didn't feel safe, I'm probably not going to complain to my landlord.
Are the people who are leasing out properties that are unsafe or that are infested with rodents or other vermin and are in unsafe neighborhoods, are they part of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, or are these individuals?
Almost universally not a member of the association. But, you've got the county health rules. You've got minimum housing standards that they have to comply with. There is enforcement. There's good enforcement. The fundamental problem is neither greedy landlords nor lazy consumers, but that gap between the buying power of low wages. Carol mentions 150,000 people below poverty in Mecklenburg and what's appropriately called the fair costs of housing. So there's this gap, and for maybe 25% of those households, they've received a subsidy. The other 75% don't get a subsidy. So that's the fundamental problem. The market works great, middle income and upper income. At the lower part of the income strata, rental strata, it doesn't work particularly well because the wages are too low to afford reasonable housing.
And we've talked about affordable housing and the dearth of it here in the past, and the fact that the city really has no tools in its toolkit to mandate that X amount of units be set aside for low-income people who can't afford the major rent. Is there any move or any feeling inside those people that you deal with who own these complexes and these individual apartments that do they feel at all a need to be part of this movement?
Some are. Some are volunteering it with rezonings. We've seen that in the South Park area. We're seeing it in far west Charlotte. So some do that, and particularly companies that are locally based that are more engaged in the community to volunteer a set-aside. But the deeper the subsidy, the harder it is to make the numbers work. If you're helping households that make $50,000 a year, it's a lot easier to do that than households that make $18,000 a year.
Right. When we come back, I'd ask you now, but we don't have time to get the answer to the question. I want to find out what the rules and the regulations are which govern evictions for people, and because a lot of people don't know their rights. A lot of renters don't know what their rights are, and we will find out about that, among other things. And later on in the program, we'll meet somebody who's been affected by eviction and talk about what that has done, what the impact of that has been on their life. Excuse me. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rate of eviction in Charlotte-Mecklenburg and how it impacts people and how it affects the cycle or the circle, the spiral of poverty. If you are poor, your chances of becoming evicted are greater than not. And if you become evicted, your chances of becoming even more poor increase because of it. Carol Hardison is here. She is CEO of Crisis Assistance Ministry, which provides assistance to those who have have been evicted or who are facing it. Mary Newsom is with us, Director of Urban Policy Initiatives at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. They have studied the incidence of eviction in Charlotte in three separate reports. And Ken Zemanski, Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. What are the rules and the regulations that govern eviction? How late with your rent do you have to be before the landlord has a right to proceed on an eviction?
Yeah. The housing providers, and I prefer that term over landlords, I think that's kind of draconian, wish they never had to file, but eventually they want to get their asset back. And often that might be after 11 days or 15 days or 20 days, something like that.
Yeah,
they wouldn't file before then for either statutory or practical reasons. So you can invoke a late fee, which is 5% of the rent, on the 6th of the month. So most filings take place between, say, the 11th and the 20th. And then you file with the clerk of superior court. There's a court date set. And then there'll be a lawsuit before a judge who's called a magistrate. And the magistrate will listen to the facts of the case. Sometimes there'll be lengthy discussion, but oftentimes it'll be very brief. It depends on the nature of the alleged dispute and whether it was nonpayment of rent or other concerns. And then at that point, allegations of housing quality, habitability can come into play. If the housing provider wins the suit, then it goes into the sheriff's department. So you've got a kind of a convoluted mix of clerk and sheriff's and folks and deputies all doing things in this process. And then they eventually would, and again, that's about a third of those that are filed, proceed with the so-called dispossession or lockout, which is kind of a difficult thing to do, but that might be 45 days after the rent was due or so. It might be a little bit more, it might be a little bit less. Depends on the nature of the workload and the actions that the various folks in the process took.
So if the eviction is successful, the whole thing takes about 45 days from the time you initiate the lawsuit.
Housing providers.
A housing provider is out of rent for about 2 months in total.
At least one and a half, can be two. Yeah.
Okay. And if it is not, are most of these evictions because of lack of payment, or are there other issues like the housing provider discovers that they're tearing the unit apart, or they're selling drugs out of the unit, or whatever?
About 80% are for nonpayment. The others are for breach of the lease rules or illegal activity.
And if they are not successful, if the the tenant makes a case for themselves, what happens then?
Well, they would win the lawsuit, and they'd have the right to stay.
And on what kinds of circumstances are they? What kinds of evidence do tenants bring that to convince the magistrate they have a right to stay?
And the habitability comes into play because you have an implied warranty of habitability. You've got to provide minimum housing quality. And if you don't, you're eligible for paying the tenant the monies in arrears, rent abatement. So if they can bring photos and say, look, we've got rats, we've got holes in the wall, we've got mold, we've got other problems, the roof is leaking, that judge or another judge can award rent abatement.
Now, I read yesterday that if you have evidence like holes in the wall or photographs of holes in the wall, photographs of bug infestation, rats, etc., broken pipes, toilets that don't flush, etc., you can't just bring it on a smartphone. You have to print those pictures out, because your smartphone cannot be entered into evidence. Is that correct?
I've heard that, and that's really up to the judge in terms of what they consider to be the rules of evidence.
Mary, you're nodding vigorously.
Yeah, several of us sat in on eviction court for several days, and they're run by magistrates who are don't have to have law degrees even. It's essentially small claims court. And they tell everyone in the courtroom, don't even bring out your phone or we'll confiscate it. So if you've
taken photographs,
yeah, you got to get them printed out.
You have to go get them printed out. That's another cost.
Exactly.
Because you're going to do that. Most people don't have access probably to computers and printers.
Right.
You have to go to Kinko's and do it.
Yeah. Now, one of the cases I sat in on, the magistrate was very careful, and the case involved domestic violence, and the tenant was being kicked out for non-payment of rent. She said they were kicking around because she wanted them to fix the locks because her ex-husband had busted them in a couple of times. And the magistrate knew that there's a state law that says if you're a domestic violence victim, you can't be evicted if that's the only reason. And so she did look at some pictures that I take it back. It was the other magistrate did look at some pictures that were on somebody's phone, but evicted the tenant anyway for bizarre reasons.
So is this a, process, this eviction process, from the housing provider's point of view, and is it something they would rather not do? Is it difficult? Do they see this as a difficult process, or is it just an inconvenience and a loss of revenue for 60 days?
It's all the above. It's a hassle. It's something you'd rather not go about doing. You'd rather manage your asset, maintain the property, respond to resident inquiries, complaints, service orders. That's what you want to do. You want to have a satisfied customer. It's a serious kind of waste of time, and it's you don't make any money doing evictions. It's bad public relations. You know, it's just something that we wish we could avoid at all costs. And I think it's beneficial that the community's been studying this to learn more about the nature of it, the households affected. And I think one of the things we need to explore is what happens to evicted households. Where do they go? Do they become homeless? Do they double up? Are they couch surfing? We need to know more about that.
What does happen to them? What happens to their possessions? I mean, everybody, even if you're poor, has possessions. So what happens to them if they win the lawsuit? And the sheriff comes and padlocks the door. I guess they put your furniture out on the front lawn.
They do not do that in North Carolina. But and Ken can correct me on this. The landlord has to keep it locked. The tenant has 10 days, I think, to arrange to come get the possessions. And if they don't, then the landlord has to get rid of the possessions. One woman I interviewed who had been evicted was basically carrying all her possessions in her van. Driving from place to place with most of what she owned in her van.
Are landlords, for the most part, willing to work with people who fall behind on the rent and have a legitimate reason for falling behind on the rent?
I think yes, and the longer the relationship, if that lessee's been there for 2 or 3 or 4 years, there's probably more of an interest in doing that. And it depends on the relationship between the provider and the consumer and to what extent the facts of the matter, whether they've got income coming, whether there can be a loan from a relative or a friend, and whether they can pay the arrears and then pay the ensuing month's rent. The challenge is when they get behind, they never can quite catch up over time, and then that July rent, you'd be behind in September, right? October, November.
I was going to ask you, Carol, if you get several months behind, are you likely ever to be able to catch up?
It's certainly going to be hard if you're several months behind. But, you know, coming back to what y'all were just talking about, you know, these are families who got home at 4 o'clock in the morning because they were security guards at night protecting mm-hmm. our buildings. And there's often not a truly a person to have a relationship with. It's corporately owned, and they don't even know who to build a relationship with and wouldn't know how to begin that. So these are folks who, if they spend 1 hour in court, that's an hour that they've missed work that their employer could tell them their job is gone when they come back.
Right.
So there's the complexity of the lives that we want to think about. But no, if you've gotten 3 months behind, it's going to be very hard.
So our eviction rate, though it's high and twice as high as some of our peer cities, pales by comparison to places like North Charleston, South Carolina, which is the city with the highest eviction rate, 16.5%. Greensboro is higher than Charlotte, 8.41%. Columbia is higher, 8.22%. And so is Winston-Salem at 7%. Other than that, Mary, what do these cities have in common with Charlotte?
They're in the Carolinas. I do think that there's...
What does that mean?
Well, I don't know. I think it's an interesting piece of the puzzle. One of the... if you go back to the Chetty study from however many years ago, which looked at economic mobility, I looked at the whole list, not just the top 100, and the Carolinas were robustly represented on the list of cities where people born into the lowest quintile had a hard time moving ahead. I'm not exactly sure what factors play into that, but there's something. Carolinas are not high income places. They have very low unionization rates. Maybe that helps people get into middle income. I don't know.
Yes, because despite people's reluctance to want to be in a union, union wages are higher.
Yes.
Go figure. If you look at the list of cities where evictions tend to be higher, almost all of the cities are in the Southeast.
Yes. I think that's not an accident. I just don't know that anybody's been able to really tease out how much of it is racial animosity, which exists in, pretty much all over America from what we know. How much of it is just longtime patterns of, and Carol's kind of nodding her head.
No, I agree. And impacts of growth, right? The South is booming from Tampa to Atlanta to Charlotte and on beyond. And so the economic growth. I think it's just that this dichotomy. We understand about income inequality, and we're living it, and the poor are getting poorer.
Mary emails, I'd be curious to hear from your guests what role racism, both blatant and institutional, plays in the housing challenges we face in Charlotte, because this sounds like a holdover from Jim Crow. How much of it is racially based?
Well, or just, you know, Matthew Desmond pointed out in his book, you know, mass incarceration is what we know is it's called the new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander says. And Matthew Desmond points out the other side of that is thousands and millions of African-American women who are left alone to raise children.
According to something called the Eviction Lab, North Carolina has 170 evictions per day. South Carolina has 112. Experts say that wages in this area are not keeping pace with the cost of living, that laws favor landlords, and that people in the Southeast carry the most debt of anybody else in the country. Would you agree with that from your experience, Carol?
Yes, and I would also say, back to the growth point, businesses come here because they're not going to have to pay high wages, and it's a good cost of living. We're very affordable in the South if you're middle and upper income. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because wages are low and things that help the folks that we're talking about are not available.
Yeah. About 45% of renters in Mecklenburg County are considered to be cost burdened, where they're spending more than 30% of their gross income on housing. We also know that rents are rising quickly in Charlotte as the housing stock becomes less available, and as new apartments go up, they're not building low-income apartments, they're building luxury apartments for the most part. So is this situation actually getting worse as the housing stock increases?
You know, rents have gone up 36% in 5 years. So you come home from work every day and your rent is rising and your wages are not.
I was at an interesting event last week, and Willie Ratchford of the Human Rights, Human Relations Council, the discussion of affordable housing came up, and he said, we're making a mistake by treating it only as a problem of supply. It's also a problem of wages. And I would add, it's a problem of the financial markets as well, because suddenly real estate is what Wall Street is investing in.
Right.
And that's driving up a lot of the prices. You know, investors are buying houses in low-income neighborhoods and renting them to people. And that's driving up the cost of housing.
And people are going in and gentrifying neighborhoods and taking formerly yes. affordable housing and fixing it up and flipping the house and making it desirable to upper-income people. We've been talking about eviction, its causes, its impact on people's lives. Let's hear from somebody whose life has actually been impacted, negatively affected by eviction, not once but twice. Julia Burgess is a Crisis Assistance Ministry client, and she is here to tell her story. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
First of all, you've been evicted twice in Mecklenburg County. When was your first eviction?
My first eviction was back in 2015. My husband and I were living in a complex where one of my barriers is because I am disabled, so I have limited income. And I also had a felony record from about 15 years ago. So what puts me in a position is I'm not allowed to put myself on a lease without losing the opportunity of having a place. Well, because I had my name added to the lease and they said, you have a record 15 years ago, you're in violation of the lease. So they made my husband and I leave. So we became evicted.
So let's back up. Let's back up.
Here. Absolutely.
So if you have a felony arrest or conviction on your record, you're not allowed to rent an apartment?
Historically, most providers took that stance, but the Supreme Court action with disparate impact suggests they shouldn't take that stance, that they need to look at each applicant individually, and it depends on the nature and the severity of the offense and how it relates to the operation of that community.
So you and your husband had a temporary loss of income. You got behind on the rent. You went to the rental office and wanted to put your name on the lease in addition to his, because it was in his name. Why did you want to do that?
Well, the reason was because they were actually beginning to ask again. Like I said, I am disabled. I'm epileptic. So when the office began seeing the ambulances coming so many times, they inquired, are you guys okay? My husband said, well, my wife has been having seizures. You have a wife? They said, no, well, we need to add it to the lease. It was no longer the issue. So it was not something that I deliberately didn't want to do. I knew because of past experience. So we took the opportunity to relocate. We returned back to Charlotte. excuse me, we returned back to Charlotte in 2016. We lost our son to suicide, and my husband was critically injured. He was the sole breadwinner, so our income was drastically cut. We came back here, and I wasn't eligible for many of the affordable housing programs due to a conviction of 15 years ago and the eviction that I had on my record already. The affordable housing places were saying you couldn't have an eviction that wasn't so many years that forced my husband and I to be homeless. Because of his lack of income and not being able to be gainfully employed to get a job where he can get the health coverage to tend to his wounds, we stayed homeless in our truck. We were able to go to crisis ministry, but not into shelters because there were not many shelters that would house a husband and wife. Wow. Crisis ministry was a great help, but they were not able to find a place, give us that jump of a deposit, or even talk to certain landlords on our behalf to get back into a stable home. My husband and I took it upon ourselves. We found a home, but it's not considered affordable. I pay over a third of our income just to live in one bedroom to feel safe, especially because of the nature of the tragedy that we experienced. It was detrimental to me. So I find myself, went to crisis where they were able to assist me with the rent. But what I found out with the apartment complex, like you ladies and gentlemen were saying earlier, the rapport doesn't necessarily matter with these corporations and these apartments because the leasing agents are just agents. They really could care less about the tenant. So when my husband took off a day or two to be out of work because of his injury, he worked day by day. The check was short. So if you don't pay your rent by the 5th, you have 3 days. They add this late fee, which in my case is $50. My rent is already $900 for one bedroom. So after the third day, if you don't pay your rent with the late fee, guess what happens? They're going to take you to court. So now the office now has inquired the rent, the late fee, and this court cost.
Okay, hold on. We have to take a break.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. It's fine. We have to take a break. And we're going to come back. We'll hear more of this because this is a really good, it gives you a good idea of the spiral that people can find themselves in and can't get out of. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the high incidence of eviction in this part of the country and in this city. And we're talking about it with people who deal with this almost every day, including somebody who has been directly affected by this, having been evicted twice, Julia Burgess, who you've just heard from, who is a client now at Crisis Assistance Ministry. Carol Hardison's the CEO of that organization. Ken Zemanski is here, Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. And Mary Newsom is Director of the Urban Policy Initiatives at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. When Julia was telling her story, she talked about, A, having a felony conviction, which got her in trouble in the first place because her husband's name was on the lease. The apartment people didn't know that he had a wife. When they discovered that, they wanted her to put her name on the lease. That revealed the felony conviction. That resulted in eviction. Then they moved out of town and came back. Ran into some other problems and were evicted a second time. But now you have not only a felony conviction on your record, but an eviction on your record. What does that do, Mary?
It makes it very hard for you to rent another place. And because landlords will look to see, has this person been evicted before? And if you have been, that's a huge red flag. I think some of them just have policies. No way. Others may, you know, there may be some degree of mercy there. What that leads to, among other things, is there's a lot of evictions that we know happen that never make it to the court system. If you don't want an eviction on your record, that gives your landlord all the power.
You just walk away.
The landlord may say, I'll give you $200 if you'll just leave. And you don't really have any choice but to do what. So there's a
does
huge.
Does that happen a lot?
We don't know. There's no way to
because it goes unreported.
It goes unreported. It doesn't show up in the court system.
What's
nobody
your,
knows.
Ken,
I don't
what's
think
your
that
experience?
Happens in the professional management world. It happens in the rental house and duplex worlds, but not in the professional.
Where these are private units privately rented by individuals who are not members of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association.
Yeah, and the eviction thing, too, I think clearly 4 years ago or so, that was an automatic black ball, but that's modifying between the disparate impact and other business reasons of looking at the totality of that household, and not that because you were evicted, that meant that you're a bad person expending your money in a way that's not smart. You burn somebody else, I don't want you to burn me. It's not that simple anymore, and it's evolving and changing for the better.
Julia.
In regards to that, I don't necessarily totally agree with that, because though it's considered second chance, so now you add another barrier. Because I have an eviction, we want to deposit sometimes 2 and 3 times the amount to be able to move in, which is unobtainable.
It's kind of like
agencies can't pay that.
It's an insurance policy to make sure that if you don't pay the rent, they have your double, triple security deposit on file. So you've called this, Carol, a double whammy when somebody has both an eviction record and a conviction record of a felony, a double whammy. Can people recover from that? I mean, that seems to put up serious roadblocks for people.
It truly is a spiral, and this is why we know we have overflowing homeless shelters at the end of the day. It's so expensive to be poor.
Here's a good example of that. Here's a real, just one example among 1,000. Let's say that your landlord complain to the housing code people that you've got rats or your toilet isn't working, and your landlord evicts you because you've, you know, hacked off your landlord.
Because you have a right not to pay the rent.
You are wrong.
I'm wrong.
In North Carolina, you do not have a right to not pay the rent for housing code violations. A lot of people don't know that, so they withhold the rent. A lot of people, most people don't know that if it is a retaliatory eviction, you should not be evicted. So they go to court and they get evicted, and then somehow they learn. This is a, for example, they learn, oh, wait a minute, I should not have been evicted. I can appeal that magistrate's decision to district court. So you go to appeal, and it's like $125 just to appeal.
Right, and you could lose.
Yeah, and you have to pay any late rent. You have to pay all the rent. You have to pay up front.
And you're losing money because you're not working your hourly job.
So, yeah. Julia, correct me if I'm wrong. If I understand your story correctly, you were evicted twice.
Twice for underneath, yes.
And now you have found another place. Mm-hmm. How did you do that, given the double whammy that we've already talked about?
I'm teetering on edge. I'm not on my lease because of the fear of, you know, wanting to inquire. But because I am legally married to my husband, mm-hmm. and he's there, we that's where we're at. I'm holding on for the hope of finding something more affordable, where it's not going to, even if it's affordable as far as monthly payments, but allows me to be able to at least get in. I can't even get in anywhere. Sleeping in my vehicle is not an option for me any longer.
Yeah. And you went to Crisis Assistance
yes.
Ministry to get help, to get this third rental opportunity. Is
actually,
that correct?
No, actually, my husband and I got the apartment on our own by saving, because we didn't have rent to pay if we're sleeping in the truck. What happened is, because my husband wasn't gainfully consistent with his work because of his injuries, mm-hmm. he lost 2 days of work 1 week. It set our rent off. And then what happened is, after you pay those late fees, the rent, Crisis was able to assist me with a good portion, but the rent office now didn't want to accept my rent with their help unless I paid the next month as well.
Let me ask about your disability if I can,
yes.
and you don't have to answer these questions because this is personal information and you don't have to answer it, okay?
Not a problem.
You said you have epilepsy and,
yes.
and therefore you are disabled, and yet you're on this program this morning.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I am disabled. I have epilepsy due to domestic violence. However, it has not changed my desire to want to live comfortably.
Mm-hmm. Of course not. But my point is that you're on this program. I'm not sure how you got here this morning, mm-hmm. but why couldn't you be at work?
I am disabled due to my epilepsy, and I do suffer PTSD. Once again, I do not work at all. My husband is at work. I'm the voice right now.
And what does he do?
He is a foreman at a warehouse.
Okay. You are also a part of Crisis Assistance Ministry's Economic Mobility Program.
Absolutely.
Which works to stabilize people to get their financial house in order. Mm-hmm. How does that work? How is it working for you?
It is making great strides. It gives me the comfort of every day not being – I no longer have to decide between food and medicine. Crisis being able to assist me with even a portion of my rent for a period of time, it allows me to get back the financial footing that I need to maintain this high rent until I'm able to find a housing program that's more affordable.
Is Julia typical of the people that you work with at Crisis Assistance Ministry, Carol?
So it's hard to say there's a typical.
Okay.
But what is typical is, in Julia, is that it's people that are trying their best with what they have, and they have hope, and they need us in the society to maintain their dignity and not look at them as the other. Because they're working as hard or harder. If I had to wake up every day and hope that someone hired me that day to put food on the table, I can't imagine. And this service, this program that Julia has chosen to enroll in, brings a relationship into the mix. This problem that we're talking about is not solved by money alone. Our affordable housing problem is not going to be solved by buildings alone. There's relationships or social capital that many of us were born with that give us opportunities to make a phone call, mm-hmm. to have someone get to the court system and have my record expunged.
Yeah. Mary says, Mary Newsom from UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute says, not all people facing eviction are blameless. I'm putting words in your mouth here. You say that some tenants are just destructive slobs who make a huge mess for everyone.
We cannot leave that unsaid.
Yeah.
One of my colleagues, when we went to eviction court to find out about the process, she said, "Well, you know, I know a lot about this process because we had a tenant. We had to evict our tenant, and the tenant was just a jerk." You know, sometimes people are just crappy tenants.
Right.
And so I think to be balanced, we have to make clear not everyone who gets evicted is evicted because they are poor and can't pay the rent. Some people are evicted because they trash the place.
Would it also be fair to say that some people know how to play the system?
I'm sure some people do.
So how do you determine, Carol, when somebody comes to you in saying they need your help and they have been evicted or are about to be evicted and they do have problems in their lives that are fairly undeniable? How do you know you're taking a good risk on that person? How do you know they're not scamming you?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways. One, Charlotte uniquely in the 1970s came up with this concept of crisis assistance. And ever since then, our community has uniquely chosen to keep one place that people come to for this eviction prevention. And so, first of all, if they have ever faced an eviction before and sought help in the system, we're going to know it because we've got the records. Mm-hmm. And so if someone comes and says, I have 3 children living with me and I need help, I can't afford to put food on the table, our system will say, well, isn't that interesting? This gentleman a year ago claimed that those same 3 children lived with him. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to, frankly, benefit because what Charlotte has done. Secondarily, our processes are thorough of understanding. We have to see documents of income and lease. If you're living in an apartment with no income, we know there's something you're not telling us. And so it's a thorough process.
So, and I hate to do this because this is embarrassing and it's intrusive, but I'm going to ask. When somebody like Julia comes to you and she's been through these problems and they're undeniable and she's disabled because of epilepsy and PTSD, et cetera. How do you determine that that's really the case? She made it to your office. She's on this program this morning. How do you, if you can do that, you can't hold down a part-time job?
So it's a two-step process. First of all, I don't think we want people to be homeless even if they had made a mistake, and I'm not suggesting that's what this situation
right.
Okay. is. But so starting with the premise in our community, in the people who founded Crisis Assistance Ministry, believe that a mistake or an error is not enough to make you homeless, or we would probably have hundreds of thousands of more homeless people in our community. And so we start there, and so we stop the eviction, and we keep one more family from sleeping in their car.
Right.
And then we have the conversation like we are having with her, and we're understanding, like you said, you're not able to work because of this situation. We might have a conversation, and she would share with us, it turns out I've had a hobby that I've been interested in, and we could say, well, I wonder if that's something, making those necklaces you could sell on eBay. We have conversations, but that can't happen until the trauma of eviction
right.
has been stopped. And so those are conversations that we have in this program.
And you also say that people with children, families, are more likely to be evicted. Is that because their expenses are higher?
Probably. We see more families. We perhaps. We do know that right after, if an eviction is not able to be stopped, as someone referred to earlier, right after they will often sleep on someone's couch. And so perhaps that's easier for a single person.
Most people in Charlotte, most people listening to this program have probably never experienced this, and they probably don't know very much about this side of the equation, this side of the financial equation that gets people into these situations, and a lot of it is generational. Mm-hmm. They came from poverty. They've never been able to work their way out of poverty for a myriad reasons that we've talked about on this program over the. How many are because of generational poverty? How much of it is because people have made unfortunate decisions or have acted irresponsibly or have been the victim of somebody else? Who have gotten them into this bad situation? How many of people are simply people who have made a mistake from which they have not been able to recover?
Every situation is unique, and you have just described major categories that we see every single day.
How many of these people are just like us, but for the grace of God?
Most of them. There are people who have apartments that are just as bad a condition as was described here earlier, mm-hmm. and they can pay a cleaner to come in every week, or someone can pay it for them, or they can, you know, like I said earlier, contact someone who can expunge their record. We also need to remember, when you talk about generational poverty, that is generational toxic stress. Studies show that when you're born into a home that faces trauma, you're going to have most likely toxic stress that's going to physically and mentally impact you later in life. So we may call it a mistake. As it was referred to earlier, there's PTSD that we are not in this society, I hope, willing to equate the mental trauma that has occurred with a conscious mistake.
That's one of the things we're talking about with these kids along the border who have been taken away from their parents, that they're going through PTSD that will be with them for the rest of their lives. Your organization is designed to help people in crisis at the moment, but you see a larger problem. You say that the fact that an appetite for prevention simply does not exist, and you say there seems to be a lot of rental subsidies available once people are homeless, but that prevention is more humane and more cost-effective. Therefore, why is there no appetite for that?
You know, it seems to be, it's something I've seen all my life, that you look at, again, in the prison system, we seem to be willing to arrest, but do we, while someone's in prison, think about what we could do to prevent their next crime? So prevention is hard in general. I don't think it's just specific to this condition, but it's just easier to see how to fix a problem, and it's very hard to explain the money you will save.
And finally, Charlotte's booming economy has actually hurt these people that need the most help, because FEMA says this county, Mecklenburg County, no longer qualifies for aid through their emergency food and shelter program because our unemployment and poverty rates are below the program's threshold. What does that mean to your organization and to organizations like yours in 20 seconds or less, 10 seconds or less?
$500,000 amongst seven organizations means nights in shelter, food from food pantries. At Crisis Assistance Ministry, it's $220,000 of rent, which is hundreds of people who need that help.
You don't see a solution at the moment, do you?
Not at this second.
Carol Hardison, CEO of Crisis Assistance Ministry. Ken Zemanski, Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. Mary Newsom from UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. And thanks to Julia Burgess, who's a Crisis Assistance client. Thank you all.